Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have crazy, bad, and more crazy martinis for you today as we get set for the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And that's where we'll start with our first crazy martini, Jim. The weekend of the cable news channels has just been wall-to-wall with pregame. It's almost like you need Lee Corso with his headgear out there to tell you who he thinks is going to win this debate, although, of course, it's largely subjective. But since it's 2016, most of the chatter in the last couple of days has had very little to do with actual issues, how policies would affect the lives of everyday Americans. Instead, we get things like the Hillary Clinton campaign inviting Mark Cuban to sit in the front row of the debate audience to troll Donald Trump, and Trump responding by publicly mulling over the idea of inviting Jennifer Flowers to be his guest in the front row of the debate. And if that weren't enough, we get this from Politico. Hillary Clinton's campaign is hoping Lester Holt is no Matt Lauer. Clinton campaign manager Robbie Mook told CBS this morning that his expectation for Holt on Monday night, when Clinton and Donald Trump square off in the first presidential debate, is that he call out Trump's lies. Lauer was assailed by his colleagues in the media for allowing Trump's assertion that he didn't support the Iraq war go unchecked during NBC's Commander-in-Chief forum earlier this month. We're really focused on this opportunity that Hillary has to speak directly to the voters on the issues, Mook said, but we are concerned that Donald Trump may lie. He may throw misinformation out there, and that Hillary will have to spend all of her time trying to correct the record rather than talking about the things she wants to accomplish. So the warning is out there, I guess, for Lester Holt, Jim. But once again, we shouldn't be surprised that the circus atmosphere has taken hold here.
We shouldn't. Now, I don't know about you, Greg. I detect more than a little bit of an undertone of, hey, Lester, nice reputation you got there. Be a shame if something happened to it. A lot of people are having accidents lately, like Matt Lauer and Jimmy Fallon, you know. Everybody loved them up until recently, and now all of a sudden, they went up against Trump and didn't press him too hard, didn't call him a liar, didn't provoke him too much, and as a result of that, everybody now hates them. You wouldn't want to be like that now, would you? Other thoughts that kind of just come to mind, this is kind of previewing a piece that should be on National Review Online later today. Greg, you and I have long memories. We remember Candy Crowley.
Yes.
Right? Jumping in and basically saying, oh, no, Obama did call Benghazi a terror attack the day afterwards, when it was this very generic acts of terror will never make us weak or something like that. He worded it so vaguely. Yeah, he could have been talking about Benghazi. He could have been talking about something else or just a generic, we're not going to let you kill Americans. Of course, it was in the days afterwards, Susan Rice came out and kept saying, oh, it was all a spontaneous protest because of a video, et cetera, et cetera. Candy Crowley, I thought, was the worst performance of any debate moderator in that moment for jumping out and making that comment. And basically, because Obama at that point was like, oh, say it a little louder, Candy, you know, basically coming out and saying, this candidate is right, this candidate is wrong. And oh, by the way, she got her facts wrong. This was an anomaly in 2012. Clearly, to the Clinton campaign, they want this to be the new normal, right? They expect the job of the debate moderator is to help the Democratic nominee and hurt the Republican. I don't know. We have no idea what to expect from Lester Holt tonight, but they're setting the expectations pretty clearly there. And I think you can kind of see this kind of, you know, plays into this increasing psychology of the Clinton campaign. You know, last week we made fun of her for saying, why am I not ahead by 50 points? They're really baffled. They're really furious. They cannot believe the American people have the audacity to consider voting for the other guy. And I don't think it's a good look for them, and we'll see how this shakes out, if anyone comes out in her performance tonight.
What is the expectation, just on the surface? I think Hillary's going to try and make Trump look clueless, and I think Trump's goal is to not look like a jerk. Is that about right?
Yeah. People have been saying whether the expectations are lower for Trump, that if he manages to not flip out and start taking bites out of the lectern, he'll be in great shape. I think she's in... For obvious reasons, Hillary Clinton is not asking me for advice. But if I actually had a chance to talk to her, I'd say something like, Hillary, everybody knows the weaknesses of Trump. Everybody's familiar with him. Very few people are voting for Donald Trump because they think he's a terrific guy who's always honest, who knows the detail of policy, who's thought through the ramifications of all of his ideas, who has no bad or unsavory supporters or anything like that. you need to make a positive case for yourself. And I would point out that because people feel like the country's not in good shape right now, you have to persuade people that you're going to be an agent of change, that you're going to actually alter things from Obama, while at the same time being a Democrat and not trying to be too hard on him. I don't think she's going to be able to do that. My sneaking suspicion is she thinks if she goes out and attacks Trump enough, she'll win. And I'm not convinced that's what's going to do that much good, unless, you know, unless she really knows how to push Trump's buttons and he, you know, loses his temper or something like that. I think he has to go up there, not drool on himself, seem reasonable, seem presidential, and I think he could end up doing himself some good tonight.
Be fascinating to see, potentially, or it could just really be an awful hour and a half. We'll see. That's our expectation. On to the bad martini now. And Jim, this one broke on Friday, so it's a couple of days old, but it is fairly significant. And it follows in a pattern of what we've seen from other Republican presidential hopefuls who didn't do as well as Ted Cruz. You know, Rick Perry once called Donald Trump a cancer to conservatism. Now he's sitting on the Hannity show right next to him saying what a great job he's going to do. Bobby Jindal said he should never have his finger on the nuclear button or anywhere close to it. Now he's endorsing him. Marco Rubio, of course, had many less than flattering things to say about him. He's pretty quiet in his support of him, but he is publicly on the record. Ted Cruz, different story. Ted Cruz, of course, got the second most delegates, which in presidential politics is good for nothing. He was less than cordial towards Trump towards the very end of the campaign. Here he is as voters were going to the polls in Indiana, which was just hours before Cruz got out of the race in May.
I'm going to tell you what I really think of Donald Trump. This man is a pathological liar. He doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. He lies practically every word that comes out of his mouth. The man cannot tell the truth, but he combines it with being a narcissist. A narcissist at a level I don't think this country's ever seen. Donald Trump is such a narcissist that Barack Obama looks at him and goes, "Dude, what's your problem?" The man is utterly amoral. Morality does not exist for him.
Then at the convention, Cruz quietly congratulated Trump for winning the nomination, but then got booed off the stage, essentially, for this combination of quotes.
And to those listening, please, don't stay home in November. If you love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
And so that was a constitutional argument. The next day in Cleveland, he had a very different explanation.
That pledge was not a blanket commitment that if you go and slander and attack Heidi, that I'm going to nonetheless come like a servile puppy dog and say thank you very much for maligning my wife and maligning my father.
Well, what a difference a couple of months makes. On Friday afternoon, Ted Cruz on Facebook, "This election is unlike any other in our nation's history. Like many other voters, I have struggled to determine the right course of action in this general election. In Cleveland, I urged voters, please don't stay home in November. Stand and speak. Vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket whom you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution. After many months of careful consideration, of prayer, and searching my own conscience, I have decided that on Election Day, I will vote for the Republican nominee, Donald Trump. I've made this decision for two reasons. First, last year, I promised to support the Republican nominee, and I intend to keep my word. Second, even though I've had areas of significant disagreement with our nominee, by any measure, Hillary Clinton is wholly unacceptable, and that's why I have always been never Hillary." His six areas of particular disagreement: Supreme Court, Obamacare, energy, immigration, refugees, internet freedom. And finally, he says, "I pledge to endorse the Republican nominee. I'm honoring that commitment. And if you don't want to see a Hillary Clinton presidency, I encourage you to vote for Trump." So, Jim, a lot of different explanations here. Some say he's just coming around. Some say it's to make his political future easier. Some say his donors forced him to do this. In the end, though, after saying he couldn't support a guy who insulted his wife and dad, unless he got a private apology, this is a hard one to swallow.
Yeah, I gave Ted Cruz a lot of grief about this Friday afternoon. A lot of people go, "Oh, you hate Trump, so you're upset that Cruz flipped." It's a little more complicated than that. I'm saying, look, we kind of knew most Republicans were going to line up behind the Republican nominee, right? This is who you are. This is my team. This is my side. I don't like the guy we nominated, but we're going to line up behind him. There are a few exceptions. The folks who are not endorsing him, the Mitt Romneys of the world, Jeb Bushes of the world, aren't running for office again, right? If you're a Republican and you want to run for office again, most of them are saying, all right, I'm not a big fan. I got my differences with them, but we got to stop Hillary. So everybody do that. And by the convention, it was pretty clear most Republicans were shifting in this direction. And then at the convention, Ted Cruz did what I thought was a bold, risky, I believe at the time it was over principle. I believe it was, you know, that, you know, Ted Cruz thought the party had made a terrible mistake in nominating Trump. And he was not, he was going to be the guy who called out the emperor's new clothes. This was a bad idea. He said it was a bad, well, he'd originally been fairly positive towards Trump back in the last fall. And a lot of us noticed that when everybody else was turning their fire on Trump, Ted Cruz, I believe it was Les Lyon, was that, you know, the only hope for the establishment is Donald Trump and myself in a steel cage match. Do you remember that, Greg?
I do.
And indicating that he was not going to be critical of Trump. And then, of course, by the time it came down to the two of them, and by the way, National Review endorsed him. Most of us were who were anti-Trump were like, okay, whether or not he was our first pick in this, and when the primary began, he was the, you know, strongest remaining non-Trump alternative, an indisputable conservative. Let's go with this guy. Fell short in Indiana. But it looked like Ted Cruz was going to be the guy who was going to take his lumps, wasn't afraid to get booed on that convention stage, and that even if it cost him, he was going to stick by his principles and he was going to say no. And then the polls changed. And that, you know, the, and when he says, oh, all these policy positions Trump has, wait a minute, he had the exact same policy positions in summer, right? It's not like Trump has suddenly, oh, wait, I suddenly discovered conservatism or anything like that. Now, what's changed since the summer? Well, the odds of Donald Trump winning look better. Now, if you are the most prominent senator who refused to endorse the Republican president, yeah, your life is probably going to get a lot more difficult, you know, in a Trump presidency. There's obviously a lot of talk about Ted Cruz facing a primary challenger in 2018. You know, those are the political realities. What I don't get, Greg, and what strikes me is that makes me think this is just this giant boneheaded move that will stick with Cruz for the rest of his life. He could have gotten on the bandwagon before the convention and avoided all this. I think he really gets the worst of both worlds. I think the people who were never Trump or anti-Trump obviously are really mad at him today. And I don't know about you, Greg. I don't think that many Trump folks are really going to be all that enthused about this belated quasi-endorsement or declaration that he's voting for him. I think he looks craven. I think he looks the opposite of the principled position he was trying to take this summer. And you know, obviously, he's likely to have a long career as a Texas senator for, you know, many years to come. But I think he's always going to be seen as a guy who is not nearly as principled as he claims to be and will shift based on which way the political winds are going.
This was a bad move. I think it was a bad judgment. I think it was not based on principle, unfortunately. But, Jim, I kind of find myself in this weird pickle because while I still, you know, think well of Cruz in terms of policy, I think he made a terrible decision here, and I think well in general of the Never Trump movement, the reaction, and I'm specifically not talking about you, and I'm not talking about others like Jonah, David French, and to the extent that he is officially Never Trump, I don't know if Rich is or not, but some of the elite superiority coming from the Never Trump types, whether it's the move by Cruz or others who go in that direction with more reluctance. I don't know if it's unbecoming is the right word, or it's just annoying with the moral superiority coming from all different angles, from the people who are for Trump, who look down on the Never Trump, the Never Trump, who look down on the people grudgingly coming over to Trump. What do you make of all that?
Rubbing you the wrong way. Greg, you're not the first person I've heard that from.
I'm sure it's not.
Close friends over beers telling me to shut up, kind of stuff like that. And not nearly as polite as you put it there, Greg. So look, the one point that I will concede, not that anybody appointed me Never Trump, not that I am King Never Trump, not that I speak on behalf of it. I do feel like the case against Trump has been made. People who read me every day probably notice that I'll make fun of Trump every now and then, but you rarely hear me saying, here's why you shouldn't vote for Trump, et cetera. And I've kind of let that die down since the convention. I think it's pretty clear. You know, it's not like there's going to be some last minute, unless, you know, Donald Trump keels over from a heart attack tomorrow, which nobody expects that to happen. But, you know, he's going to be the Republican nominee. His name's going to be on the ballot. If you think that if you got to stop Hillary Clinton, that's really the only option. I don't think it's very likely we go to these crazy 269, 269 House, the election gets thrown to the House type outcomes or anything like that. So I don't see, if you're never Trump, I don't really see what the argument, unless you want to go out and you want to say we're pro-Hillary. And there are some folks who have not done that. We talked about George H.W. Bush. I think Jamie Kirchick tried to make the argument that Hillary Clinton was a conservative choice in this election, and I just was left thoroughly unpersuaded by that. I don't think, you know, Trump being bad doesn't make Hillary good, and Hillary being bad doesn't make Trump good either. And so I kind of feel like the Never Trump case has been made. Now it's time to leave people to make their decisions, to evaluate the candidates as they are. For all the folks who are voting for Trump because they feel like they got to stop Hillary, I don't have a strong argument against that. That doesn't strike me as crazy or outlandish thinking. The people who have been arguing that Trump is the best choice from the very beginning, Hannity, those are the folks who I still have a bone to pick with,
yeah,
and who I think have kind of gotten us into this mess. And I still believe that almost any normal Republican probably would be beating Hillary Clinton handily, now knowing what we know now about the FBI investigation and things like that. But we'll see how things shake out there. Again, I think it's now also safe to say that with Cruz having flipped, I don't think there is, you know, maybe Ben Sasse. I understand Mike Lee has not formally endorsed Trump, but I don't think he's really argued against him either. So I think it's a very, you know, limited window of folks who, you know, that if Donald Trump comes to be seen as a major mistake for the party, which I will point out is looking less and less likely as Trump does better in these polls. In that scenario, if there's a broad consensus that Trump was a disastrous idea and we never should have done it, and anybody who backed it, you know, is gullible and we shouldn't nominate this person, then you have a very slim pickings in 2020. And, you know, if this was a bad idea, it was a bad idea that almost every Republican was willing to throw in with by the time, you know, the end of September rolled around.
It's just a lot of ugliness all the way around. And the fact that you see and can respect the various arguments is one of the reasons why your commentary doesn't bug me. And it's not just because we do this podcast together. So
also, we have to do a podcast together.
I think maybe if Trump whittles down his Supreme Court list to one and Mike Lee is still on it, then maybe Mike Lee.
Maybe he wouldn't be able to do it. Maybe he wouldn't be able to publicly endorse if you're like, because it would be seen as bribery.
Yeah, that's a good point. As long as we're talking about one major party runner-up kind of abandoning the principles, we might as well go with the other one too. Bernie Sanders on Face the Nation with John Dickerson, and as you probably remember from the Democratic convention, Bernie very reluctantly going along with Hillary Clinton as the nominee. And one of the questions John Dickerson brought up is, hey, a lot of the people that like you, you know, millennials and other people on the left, they really don't like Hillary either. They really don't like Trump, but they're not comfortable with Hillary. So they're looking at Gary Johnson. They're looking at Jill Stein from the Green Party. And they might just not vote for the Democratic nominee. And here's Mr. Political Revolution explaining why all those people are wrong.
I think what the focus has got to be on now is understanding that this moment in history for a presidential election is not the time for a protest vote. It is a time to look at which candidate is going to work best for the middle class and working families.
We're not talking about college debt and fighting bigotry and climate change and all that stuff. Jim, I thought the whole point of his campaign is that this was the year for that vote.
Greg, this is the year of a revolution by going with the system. We will resist by complying. We will fight them by doing what they want us to do. When I think about overturning the system, I think of Hillary Clinton, who has been in the system since 1992. Is that clear? Nothing will stick it to the millionaires and billionaires and the big banks than by nominating the person who's the millionaires and the billionaires and the big banks. Yeah, look, you know, Bernie Sanders should not be throwing any rocks at Ted Cruz these days. He's building a glass house on an island in Vermont.
Man, talk about abandoning the revolution. That was a worse ending than Les Mis.
You know, and maybe the lesson of this is, in the end, partisan loyalties are always going to be very strong. Almost everybody's going to line up with their side. If that's the lesson from this, then if you're somebody who really wants to see either one of the parties change, you want to see a really dramatic difference in the parties and all that, then this is a bad sign for you. That ultimately, the primary fights will, you know, they will be forgotten. They will be overcome. In the end, everybody will line up either behind their nominee and come around to them, or they will dislike the other party so much that they'll forgive almost anything in their party's nominee. And that's great start to the week, Greg.
Jim, enjoy, if that's the right word for the debate tonight. I'm sure we'll have plenty to say about it tomorrow. Talk to you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.